You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last year, investigators found that at least three banks and perhaps as many as 16 were manipulating LIBOR, an international interest rate that affects more than $5 trillion in assets worldwide. But what if LIBOR isn't the only benchmark rate that banks have been manipulating? Well, in recent months, American authorities have been investigating whether brokers and bankers have manipulated a rate known as ISDA Fix. Joining me now to explain is Matt Taibbi, a contributing editor to Rolling Stone. His latest novel, Everything is Rigged, appears in the May 9th issue of the magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi, Matt.
Thanks, Leonard. How are you doing?
So what is ISDA Fix?
Is the fix. It's just it's one of many benchmark rates that exists in the financial world that, like LIBOR, they are rates that are created when financial companies self-report about prices, and then they use the data collected from private companies to create an aggregate, and that will be used as a benchmark in financial contracts all over the world. LIBOR, for instance, is the basis for almost all variable rate investments, as many as $500 trillion worth of products. So this is a similar thing. It's interest rate swaps, which is a little bit of a smaller market, $379 trillion.
Now, what are interest rate swaps?
So an interest rate swap is it's hard to explain, but
maybe that's why we don't hear much about
exactly. Exactly. This is one of those things that it's so complicated and so difficult to do on TV, or in the news that you just don't hear about it so much. But the simplest form of an interest rate swap is if you have a variable rate investment, if you, like, you're a city or a town, for instance, and you borrowed money at a variable rate, but you want the safety and security of a fixed rate. You want to make fixed payments from now on. You can pay a bank to swap your debt. In other words, you'll pay the fixed rate to them. They'll pay the variable rate.
And well, the fixed rate has got to be higher because it's safer.
Well, yeah. Well, that's what the banks are basically betting, that they know more about where the movements and interest rates are going over the life of your loan than you do. So they'll basically determine how much they think you'll probably end up owing in the variable rate contract. Then they'll set a price that's a little bit higher than that. You'll pay that, and then they make the money off the difference.
Now, the banks, as you say, report their swap rates voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
That's an invitation to not telling the whole truth, isn't it?
Well, this gets back to what happened with LIBOR. It's kind of a theme that I keep coming back to in my work, is that there's sort of a loophole in the financial system, which is that a lot of these sort of quasi-institutional parts of the financial system are dependent upon private companies that kind of have an interest in gaming the system.
Well, why would regulators allow that?
Because it's always worked in the past, and because this really hasn't come up in the past. In the case of LIBOR, we now find out from a few sources that this might have been going on for a really long time. It's incredibly easy for just one trader and one LIBOR submitter to monkey with rates just a little bit, just by making a couple of phone calls. And this can affect, billions of people around the world, and it's just a flaw in the system that hasn't been addressed.
And we only know for sure that three banks engaged in the manipulation in LIBOR.
Well,
although the suggestion is it could be as many as 16.
Yeah, there were 16 banks in the LIBOR. They call it the LIBOR panel, and this. There have been three banks that have already settled with British and American authorities, but I know there are at least four more under investigation, and there are probably going to be more that will ultimately settle.
Well, should we assume that if there was manipulation, that everybody who was on the panel would at least have some idea of what was going on?
There's a lot of circumstantial evidence that suggests that. One of the striking things that happened in the LIBOR case was that a series of emails came out between the head of the Bank of England and the head of Barclays, the CEO of Barclays. And this was during the crisis period in 2008. And there was a strong incentive for governments all over the world to have LIBOR look lower than it really was. Because what LIBOR really measures is, how do the banks feel about each other? How do they feel about the financial system in general? When LIBOR is low, that means banks are charging each other relatively little to borrow money from each other. And when it's high, that obviously means there's instability. So there were emails in which essentially the Bank of England was saying, everybody else is doing it, why aren't you doing it? And that to me indicates that you know this really was a systemic situation.
Now the rates are determined throughout the day, so wouldn't it be rather impossible for an independent organization to keep track of this every hour, every day?
Well, one of the things that they could do is use real data.
Well, how could they even obtain all of the information that they'd need to calculate the rates?
Well, the way they do it now is interesting. The way they do it now is you don't have to actually submit real numbers about what you borrowed yesterday. And again, they're submitting data about 10 different currencies and 15 different time periods. So it could be, you know, 6 month Swiss franc, it could be 1 year yen, et cetera, et cetera. But they're not submitting real data about what happened yesterday. What they're doing is they're submitting numbers about what they believe their borrowing costs will be today. So it's not, there's no direct correlation to any real numbers. If they did a real reporting system, if it was purely turn over the data about what happened yesterday, and then we'll average it all out and make a real number, then this couldn't happen.
We're not doing that.
Yeah, we're not doing that. There have been suggestions that we should do that, but we're not doing that.
My guest is Matt Taibbi, contributing editor of Rolling Stone. We're talking about the information contained in his latest article from the May 9th issue of the magazine called Everything is Rigged. The Community Future Trading Commission is looking at a London-based firm called ICAP. How many of their brokers seem to be caught up in this investigation?
Well, there's a small unit within ICAP that apparently involves something like 20 people, and they're responsible for interest rate swaps. They're the world's largest broker of interest rate swaps. And I think they're here, actually, even though it's a London-based company, I believe they're here in Jersey City.
So that's how the U.S. government can get involved? Because the U.S. government cannot investigate an English company, can it? It would have to get the British to do that.
You know, there's a real gray area here, because all of these transactions have an impact everywhere. You know, and even though, for instance, in the LIBOR case, where it might have been a Japanese trader talking to a LIBOR submitter who's also based in Japan, we were still able to bring criminal charges in that case. So I think that the jurisdictions are increasingly global with these financial regulators.
Is the investigation starting to involve other banks and firms, or is it limited to ICAP?
Well, no, they've sent out subpoenas to from my understanding, to as many as 15 banks in this investigation. So this really involves ICAP and, again, another panel of mostly the same companies that we're dealing with in the LIBOR case.
On Wall Street, aren't bankers and brokers always trying to find new ways to make money? Is this does this come out of the instinct to be innovative, or is something else going on here?
Well, this is again why I think this is such a interesting and important story, because we obviously saw lots of corruption in 2008 and you know, after the financial collapse, we heard about all sorts of things that went on, you know, fraud in the mortgage-backed securities markets, all kinds of problems. But there were accounting fraud, you know, there were the problems that went on at Lehman Brothers, but they didn't typically involve collusion between banks. And this to me, there have been a number of stories that have suggested of late that this is that kind of the next step in financial corruption, is that we've had a bunch of these stories that are about anti-competitive collusion between these super powerful companies.
And don't the antitrust laws apply in these cases?
I think they should, but curiously,
would Teddy Roosevelt be shocked by what's going on?
I think you would be. I mean, we already have a situation where one could argue, you could make the argument that just the mere fact of some of these companies owning such a massive share of the companies of the country's resources or controlling it is already monopolistic and already dangerous. But to have evidence that they're actually colluding to mess with prices or benchmark rates is extremely dangerous. If we don't aggressively do something about it, then it sets a terrible example and it leads to it leads to new cases.
It's interesting that we think of the banks as being in competition, but that's not the case. Should I assume that Chase and Citibank are all talking to each other in very friendly ways?
Well, I think they obviously do compete. I mean, there's no question that they are competitors on one level and probably primarily competitors, but there are little
on the consumer level.
On the consumer level, but there are areas in the financial universe where they work together. You know, I did a story last year about manipulation of auctions in the municipal bond service markets, which is an obscure thing that nobody has ever heard of. But basically, you know, when cities and towns go out to borrow money, they usually have auctions where banks are supposed to compete with each other for how much money they're going to pay these municipalities to in terms of investing their borrowed monies. And it turned out that these banks were and financial companies were rigging these auctions. They were basically divvying up things and saying, you know, we'll take this bond issue for that city and you guys can have this hockey rink that's being built over here. And, you know, six companies paid massive multi-million dollar settlements and it wasn't even a story here in America.
Well, many years ago, Ben Bradley was here to talk about his career. And he's very proud, of course, of what happened with Watergate. And I asked him, well, why didn't you do a similar investigation of the SNL crisis? Mm. And he said, well, readers' eyes glaze over.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, there's...
But is that enough of a reason? I mean, I'm in a way, I'm complimenting you because you're one of the lone voices here. You're one of the few people who actually goes through these complicated stories. But you'd think that more financial reporters would be doing this. And there are a couple of cable stations out there that
sure
devote themselves to the Wall Street. How come we're not seeing more investigative reporting here?
I think there are a lot of reasons. I think there's a lot of outrage fatigue that people have about this story. But you know, just to take LIBOR to me, you could make the argument that it's the biggest criminal conspiracy in the history of crime. It affected as much as $500 trillion worth of financial products.
Well, does that mean me? I'm affected as well?
Absolutely. If you have a mortgage, if you have a credit card, if you the value of money itself, the value of currencies in relation to other currencies is affected by this. Everything is affected by LIBOR. But it wasn't really a widely covered story here. It was covered more in England, obviously, because the first banks to topple were British banks,
Barclays,
and then the Royal Bank of Scotland was another one that also set up. But you know, here in the United States, we hear almost nothing about it. And I think Ben Bradley is absolutely right. People, their eyes glaze over. All of this stuff is cloaked in this densely boring verbiage that is incredibly difficult to wade through, and people have a difficult time wrapping their minds around the metaphysical aspects of this kind of corruption, because it's not just simple stealing, it's literally like changing the value of stuff that you already have, and that's different from corruption that they're used to hearing about.
Matt Taibbi's article in Rolling Stone, the May 9th issue, is Everything is Rigged. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Matt Taibbi, a contributing editor to Rolling Stone, whose latest article in that magazine is Everything is Rigged. It's in the May 9th issue. We're talking about another growing scandal as far as international trade is concerned. Is changing the numbers that are reported the only way that these rates can be rigged?
I haven't thought about it, but yeah, there are probably a number of different ways. I mean, the interesting thing about LIBOR is that it didn't necessarily involve banks colluding with each other. You could have just an individual bank submitting a wrong number, and that would be enough to mess with the rates as well. So you could have it be collusion, you could have it be not collusion. There are lots of different ways that this could be affected.
Well, you describe a former broker at ICAP who saw his colleagues delay the reporting of swap prices.
Right.
How can delaying give a firm an advantage?
Well, this was a dicey area. It was funny when this story first broke. All the news agencies talked about the same thing, about how the CFTC is apparently investigating the concept that these brokers were delaying the reporting of prices of swap trades, but they couldn't come out and say exactly why anybody would do that. And the only reason that anybody would do that is because then somebody would trade ahead of that information. It would be like delaying the results of a horse race, in the period between when the race actually concluded and when the results were announced.
I could win a lot of money if that happened.
You could make a lot of smart bets. And that concept exists kind of in a lot of different places. There are a lot of people who argue that that's what high-frequency trading is, which is basically these computer programs that go out and they look at the results of trading data and they try to make instant trades before the rest of the market sees.
Which can lead to some problems, as we saw the other day when somebody joked that the president had been – the White House had been attacked.
Right.
And suddenly the market dropped –
Right.
The whole floor dropped out of it.
Flash crash.
Recovered
thing.
In just a few moments. But that's because computers can't tell whether somebody is joking or not.
Right. Right. Exactly. And there's a whole another whole rat's nest, that HFT high frequency trading thing. But we're far from getting to the bottom of that as well.
Well, the next time you're on the show. Well, let's take a call from Roger from Irvington, New York. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi, Roger.
I very much enjoy your show, and I had a comment, really, which is that we seem to tolerate these dark markets where the prices can be manipulated in derivatives and in fixed income, whereas we would never tolerate that in, let's say, the equities markets.
Right.
And I should declare an interest. I actually worked as chief technology officer at the New York Stock Exchange for a number of years, so I clearly have a little bit of a bias. But one should assume that a trader will always look to gain an advantage. And if the prices that are used to set, in this case, LIBOR, which have an enormous impact on other transactions, can be manipulated without any guarantee that the prices are real, actually that they reflect transactions, arm's-length transactions that actually happened, or that they reflect bids and offers where people are committed to those bids and offers, you should expect it to be rigged. And it's a kind of extraordinary that we would never dream of allowing the price of a security, and an equity security, to be dealt with in this way. But we seem to put up with it for some historic reason in the fixed income world and the derivative world.
Roger, do you think that's just because people don't understand what derivatives are and they haven't demanded that the same kind of transparency exists in those markets as that exists in the equities market?
I think that's probably true. I think particularly your layperson doesn't understand it as well. But I think that it's not just as simple as that. I think there are strong forces lobbying against transparency and against working with real data, because you can make a lot of money if you have a preferential source of information.
Sure.
And I would note that the Dodd-Frank reforms do actually require that swaps, for example, will start to be traded in an open and transparent way, and that the SEC and the CFTC, all these years later, have still not turned the legislation into regulations. So these new electronic open transparent facilities called swap execution facilities still don't exist years after Dodd-Frank was passed.
And do you think that's because there's been so much pushback from the people involved? There are an awful lot of people in Washington, not just in Congress, but in the administration, who may be listening to the complaints from Wall Street?
Yeah, obviously there's a lot of lobbying dollars that can be spent by people who make billions of dollars profit because they're trading in a preferential, opaque manner. And, there's big money involved here.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I remember I covered the Dodd-Frank Act, and Roger, you're absolutely right. They did successfully pass a few things in that act that would create some transparency, but there were still all sorts of loopholes and exceptions that they managed to get even before the act was passed. And now we're in the rule writing phase of it. And I think there's the lobbyists are pushing back even more. And they've delayed the implementation of these new swap execution facilities. And we just may never actually see those kinds of transparent facilities.
Thank you for calling us, Roger. But in the process, we wind up with scandals like this. Isn't there the other side to this story, which is, well, if we implement these things, maybe we won't have all these embarrassing scandals, which wind up when finally the dust settles with banks paying huge amounts of money in fines.
Yeah, but the amounts...
Although nobody seems to go to jail.
No, but nobody goes to jail, and the amounts of money that they're paying in fines are trivial compared to the amounts of money
Just the cost of doing business?
Absolutely. That's absolutely what it is. It's a pittance compared to what they can make. And that's only in the rare case that they actually get caught, and that's actually some kind of investigation and or prosecution. And we now have the Attorney General admitting that these companies are too big for us to actually criminally prosecute, which is an enormous incentive for these guys to continue to monkey around with everything that they can get their hands
on.
Well,
could this ISDA fix rigging scandal turn out to be similar to the LIBOR fixing scandal of last year?
Yeah, absolutely. It could turn out to be very similar. It's a very similar process. You know, it's another benchmark rate that upon voluntary reporting. In this case, it's about bids and offers as opposed to, you know, borrowing costs. But that same kind of system exists all over the financial landscape. It's not just interest rate swaps. It could be all kinds of commodities, you know, coal, jet fuel, anything. And until we get to a system where we're always dealing with real data and real numbers, the potential for these kinds of abuses is going to exist.
And I'm assuming that the response to the LIBOR scandal can be read as some kind of a roadmap to what will happen here as well.
Right. And that's what everybody – it's funny. I talked to one regulator who saw the Barclays settlement last year. Barclays was the first bank to settle. And they got hit with a $450 million fine. And the widespread expectation in the sort of the law enforcement community was, okay, they paid a pretty small fine, but they're going to roll on everybody, and then we're going to get real prosecutions after that. What happened instead was that turned into the template for the other settlements. You know, UBS settled, the Swiss bank. RBS, the Royal Bank of Scotland, settled. They settled for a little bit more money, but it was the same kind of deal where there was no – aggressive criminal prosecution. They paid some money, and now they're back, you know, in the free and clear. And they're still on the LIBOR panel in some cases, which is incredible.
In the May 9th issue of Rolling Stone is an article called Everything is Rigged, written by my guest, Matt Taibbi, who's a contributing editor to that publication. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, as you mentioned, LIBOR affected more than $500 trillion in assets. Would the rigging of the ISDA fix affect anything like that amount of capital?
Well, the number that the papers quoted is $379 trillion. It's a $379 trillion market. Interest rate swaps are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. Almost all major municipalities, countries use interest rate swaps. Big corporations use interest rate swaps. You might remember the Greek scandal involving Goldman Sachs, where they had some problems with their finances. That was all interest rate swaps. The long-term capital management disaster in the late 90s, that was interest rate swaps. It's a little bit harder to connect the dots for ordinary people as to where it comes out of their pocket, but it ends up affecting the economy in all sorts of ways.
And in your article, because these are hard things to explain, you liken it to having to pay $20 for a peanut butter and jelly sandwich because agriculture companies are fixing the prices of both the peanuts and the peanut butter.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Because LIBOR affects interest rates, and then you have interest rate swaps, which are in some cases are based on a LIBOR calculation as well. So if you're fixing both LIBOR and interest rate swaps, it's like it's two different layers.
So we could be manipulated twice.
Exactly. You're paying like a double corruption premium And that's just only what we may know. Who knows what else is going on? They also announced recently that, or the story broke recently that there may be an investigation into gold and silver markets. So who knows what else is going on out there? The problem is again that the potential for this kind of thing goes on everywhere, and as Roger, your caller, pointed out, we should expect that if the potential exists, there's a real possibility that it's happening.
I just misspoke. I said 500 trillion. It's 5 trillion.
No, I think it's 500 trillion.
Oh, it is 500 trillion. Okay.
Yeah.
So with all that money involved, you said earlier the Justice Department has just decided that these banks are too big to fail. Is that simply the excuse for not moving to prosecute any of them?
Yes. This goes all the way back. It's funny. Back in the late 90s, Eric Holder worked in the Clinton White House, and he was in the Justice Department. He wrote a memo, which is now kind of known affectionately as the Holder Memo, in which he talked about what he called collateral consequences, which are what do we do when we proceed with a high-level prosecution, criminal prosecution of a large systemically important company. We have to think about the innocent victims in that case, which are all the people who could lose their jobs, the communities that could be affected by the company closing, et cetera, et cetera. That memo kind of gathered dust for a while, and then Enron happened, and then Arthur Andersen happened, and they criminally prosecuted Arthur Andersen, and the company was vaporized, and 28,000 jobs were lost, and that spooked the government enormously, and they've since been gradually more and more reluctant to engage in these kinds of criminal prosecutions, and they specifically talked about collateral consequences when they didn't bring a case against the LIBOR participants.
So in poker terms, we can say that his name is appropriate as a holder, not a folder.
Right, yeah, exactly.
There have been a number of suits brought against the banks involved in LIBOR, and you write about one where the judge dismissed many of the charges. Why did federal judge Naomi Buchwald dismiss much of the case against the banks?
Yeah, there was a major kind of consolidated private lawsuit by that was filed by a number of different towns and municipalities and unions, all these different people who believe that they had lost money because of LIBOR manipulation. And that suit, the banks filed a motion to dismiss actually last year, and there was a hearing on it this March, and they made a really interesting argument. Their argument was that LIBOR is not a competitive process, so therefore we can't be guilty of an antitrust violation. We can't be guilty of anti-competitive behavior.
But they had paid fines, which isn't that an admission they colluded to manipulate LIBOR?
Exactly. The banks had already admitted to manipulation in these settlements, and the government had signed off on it. So you have all these different parties, both official and private, who had already signed off on the concept that manipulation occurred. And yet they proceed in this private lawsuit with a completely new argument, and the judge completely bought it.
Well, can we assume that this is going to wind up in the Supreme Court or at least some higher court?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think the participants and the plaintiffs in this situation are considering all their options right now. But I know it came as a shock to a lot of lawyers.
On Monday, Gary Gensler, who's the head of the CFTC, told the Financial Times that LIBOR is unsustainable and must be replaced to restore market integrity and promote financial stability. What would replace LIBOR? Would it be a rate that's calculated differently?
Yeah, I think they would come up with a system. Again, this goes back to the idea of using real numbers to calculate the benchmark. The typical LIBOR calculation, like say you have a credit card, it's a variable rate credit card, so it's LIBOR plus 5% or whatever it is. They would just replace LIBOR with some benchmark rate that was based upon real data, as opposed to banks voluntarily sending in numbers every morning.
Well, if that ever happened, if LIBOR isn't the only benchmark rate that could have been rigged, is Gensler in effect suggesting overhauling most, if not all, of the rates?
One of the CFTC commissioners, Bart Chilton, actually said that very thing last month, that You know, in the wake of LIBOR, we have to assume that all these benchmark rates are what he called legitimate areas of inquiry.
So, gold, silver,
right.
Energy markets.
Right, exactly. Commodities, anything. You know, we have this same kind of system that's based upon voluntary reporting is ubiquitous again, and they would just have to go in and find a new way to do it.
Well, the CFTC and the International Organization of Securities Commissions is investigating whether gold and silver prices have been manipulated in a way similar to LIBOR.
Right.
They went through the roof for a while.
Right.
And now suddenly gold has lost a lot of value, although would that have been because of manipulation?
It's hard to say. You know, I mean, we don't know. Obviously, there are a lot of people. There have always been people surrounding the precious metals markets who've believed that manipulation of all different varieties has gone on. There's a major a group called GATA, the Gold I forget what it's called, the Gold Something Committee, Antitrust Action Committee, and they've been pressing this idea that the precious metals markets have been manipulated for years. But this is the first time that the government has talked about investigating it seriously. So that's interesting.
On the other hand, I saw a documentary in which I'm no longer in government, but one of the top people in the Justice Department, the one who would have litigated this, said that it's really hard to make these cases in court, and that's the reason that the government hasn't pursued them.
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely one excuse.
You call that an excuse. You think it's not true? If you lay out the case correctly, do you think that the government could make the case?
Well, for example, in this entire tableau of post-2008 corruption cases, there was one serious prosecution that was kind of systemically related. They prosecuted a couple of guys involved with a Bear Stearns hedge fund, and they had, I think, overwhelming documentary evidence that these guys knew that they were selling a loser product. You know, they had emails back and forth to each other saying, like, this is never going to work in a million years, and then they would represent the opposite to their clients. And they took that case to court in California, and it went to a jury, and they acquitted. And after that, there hasn't been another filing since then. I think they are spooked. I mean, one of the things that people don't realize is that these U.S. attorney's offices have very, very limited resources. So if you think about it, are they going to go after slam dunk street crime cases or drug cases where they know they're going to get convictions? Or are they going to, you know, tangle with these banks that have limitless legal resources to tie the cases up for years and years and years?
Matt Taibbi's article in the May 9th issue of Rolling Stone is Everything is Rigged. Thanks so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.